And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Right smack dab in the middle of summer. It's a classic with record-breaking heat, throngs at the beach, heading off to the parks and byways, and just sitting around, sweating it out. We're off to Yellowstone National Park to talk about those wolves, and we get the scoop on what Robert Redford's had on his mind, and more, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The heat's on, and it's summer, and it's hot. And everyone's trying to figure out what in the world, literally, is going on. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling a little stressed out these days. As the giant missiles and bombs shred the lives of hundreds of people in Lebanon, in Israel, in Iraq, not to mention Africa and Somalia. I'm thankful I'm suffering through the heat here rather than there. But I feel it, and I think about it. And I'm baffled and I'm frustrated, to put it mildly, that humans somehow continue to believe that bombing and strafing is how to achieve peace. In my mind, it just keeps adding to the global tally of unresolved revenge. But the folks with the giant guns and missiles make the decisions, and until that changes, there really is nothing that we can do. We can't even get an honest election, so I guess the only rational thing to do is talk about something else. So today, we bring you great news about something dear to my heart. The legendary Robert Redford just announced that the Sundance Channel is about to launch a prime-time weekly 3-hour block of programming dedicated to the earth and nature and sustainability. We'll be talking to the executive vice president of the Sundance Channel, Laura Michael Cheshin, right after the news. Then we head on up to another legend, Yellowstone National Park, where we talk with Doug Smith, who's bringing us an update on the Yellowstone Wolf Pack that suffered a tremendous setback this past winter. And then we take a serious look at how the millions of farm animals are faring as the summer heat continues. Things have changed on America's farms. That's all coming up. But first, the news. The Sundance Channel is primed to launch a prime-time lineup of programming in early 2007 focused on the Earth's ecology and concepts of green living that balance human needs with responsible environmental stewardship. We'll be talking about that right after the news. One of the world's most spectacular waterfalls, the Iguazu Falls, considered one of the world's natural wonders, has been reduced to an embarrassing trickle due to the worst drought Brazil has experienced in 20 years. The great Iguazu, that normally would easily dwarf our Niagara and compares with Victoria Falls of southern Brazil, is expected to be sending thrills through the hearts of tourists come September, when the rains are expected to refill the riverways, which feed the thundering tumble. If you could choose which birds should go extinct, which ones would you choose? With an estimated 12% of known species expected to disappear from the Earth by 2100, that actually translates to 1,250, which then becomes 125 every 10 years. That number is 100 times as great as any time in the past 65 million years. So, if you have a favorite that might find its way into the fossil forests of history, you might make an effort to work really hard to keep it for yourself. Yes, it's a bit selfish, but in this case, we'll overlook it. And say what you will about global warming, it's still a more apt turn of phrase to say global weirding, because some things on planet Earth are way different than you'd expect. Take, for example, the great whale female. Seems these multi-ton fatties have shown up a bit lean during the pregnancy's past, and that never is a good thing for an expectant mom. Fatter moms do better babies make, or at least that's the way it is with whales and most wild mammals. Well, whale moms are beginning to find more food due to the earlier melting of the ice sheet in the Arctic seas, and that makes for more blubber and ultimately healthier babies when they birth in the Baja. So be prepared for some interesting surprises as global warming goes weird in the years ahead. And that's the news. There's a great show about to birth right before your ears, so let the show begin. The Wildside News has been busy for 2.5 years here trying to bring information to the public in a mainstream media format, and it's been an exciting journey so far. But I am absolutely thrilled about an announcement I read about just recently that is coming from the Sundance Channel about a mainstream TV cable network that is going to really focus on green. And to talk about that now is Laura Michael Chishin, who is the Executive Vice President of Programming and Marketing for the Sundance Channel. She's joining us now from New York. Laura, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much, Sydney. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I have to get the first question out for my listeners, and that, of course, is what's it like working with one of the world's most committed environmentalists?
It's inspiring, I have to say, working with Robert Redford. And, I mean, part of this whole initiative of a green block on Sundance Channel came from the many decades of dedication and work in the field of, you know, environmental activism that Robert Redford had dedicated his life to. So for us, for Sundance Channel to embark upon this programming initiative, which we see as long-term and permanent, was a natural, truthfully. And for him, it is actually the manifestation of something he's, I think, been hoping that we could do on the channel for a number of years. And if you watch Sundance Channel, I think generally in terms of the embracement of the concept of environmental activism, caring about the globe and the world, and, you know, issues around global warming have always been part of who we are in terms of our program offering. But now this dedicated block, I think, is going to, what we hope, is amass information, provide some amazing context, and hopefully be also aspirational for how we can all, in our small individual lives, make some change to positively affect what we see as, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of years of global denigration.
Absolutely right. But Sundance Channel is a unique format. Who do you see as your audience? Because it's a unique form of programming, and I think in the process of defining who that audience is, we really talk about the people who are going to have to lead the way to make a difference.
Exactly, Sydney. And what we actually say, we say our audience are thought leaders and creatives. Our audience tend to be people who are interested in an alternative on television. People who are looking for something different come to Sundance Channel. People who want alternative viewpoints. And, you know, we hope that we embody all of the importance of freedom of expression, freedom of speech, debate, dialogue. So if you watch Sundance Channel, I typically would characterize our viewers as, you know, people who care and are interested, not just in what's happening in the U.S., but also internationally. We run documentaries that are political in nature, environmental, obviously, but also social, cultural, arts-related, and just, you know, in terms of sort of trends in current society. We have a lot of documentary programming that we feel just reflects what's going on in day-to-day life. And you know, the green block, which we hope also doesn't just, you know, embody that which has become of a concern now, but also will become for us part of a larger community, whether it's online, because we're going to develop and create a really robust website through user-generated content, or what we provide on the linear channels, we call it, you know, the television channel as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they've heard the term a couple of times here, but we really haven't defined exactly what Sundance Channel Green is. So let's give us an overview. What are people going to find somewhere down the road here relatively soon when they turn on the Sundance Channel? What are we looking forward to?
So early next year in 2007, Sundance Channel Green will be a block of dedicated programming, probably 2.5 to 3 hours every week. We haven't determined what day of the week nor time, but I have the full intention of making it a primetime block, Plus, we'll repeat it, you know, and the programming that's within it throughout the week. But the block really is going to be factual documentary programming. We are going to what we call commission a new series, which will likely start as a 13-part, half-hour series. It's all about people, concepts, places, ideologies, and some of the movements that have already taken place in the area of environmental change. You know, who are some of the activists? Who are people that are, whether it's on the east, the west coast, and the center of the country, who are people? Who are these people, and what are they doing? So we almost make them little, you know, documentaries about people who are making a difference. We're also going to work on having what we call interstitial series, which are shorts. And we're working, you know, we're owned by NBC, Universal, CBS, and Robert Redford. So we have some incredible relationships with our parents, if you will. And we want to provide some news and updated information that will come in the short form, you know, 2-3 minute pieces. Probably work on 4 or 5 different interstitial concepts for that block. And then the third component is going to be what we call a documentary acquisition. So it will be either a 60 or a 90 minute, we call them, you know, feature docs, that look at the issues. So some examples this year, I mean, you know, Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth may show up on the schedule, or Who Killed the Electric Car? You know, there's a number of titles that have already been in the marketplace and are actually doing very well as theatrical films unto themselves. You know, people are already flocking to theaters and cinemas to see them. We want to bring those to the channel so that if you've missed them in your local theater, you know, community cinema, you'll get a chance to see them on the channel.
That is so great, because this is the thing that's not in the mainstream media. These really hard-hitting, direct, honest, truthful, forthright portrayals of what the world is about, we absolutely have to have them. And thank God for Robert Redford, who, again, is a leader. He's showing his leadership by taking on this challenge, because starting a new venture like this costs a lot of money. It takes a tremendous amount of commitment. And you've already stated that you're in this for the long haul.
Absolutely. It's not going away.
Yeah,
you know, and what our goal is to actually hopefully be part of the solution. I want the block to also inspire and be aspirational in terms of people watching the programming, you know, feeling like it isn't all apocalyptic. There are people who are making a difference. We're working with people who, when we sent the announcement and press release out last week, you know, I have to say the response just from the general public, as well as activists, environmentalists, and people who are probably in areas of design, architecture, you know, even fashion. We've had interesting feedback, people saying, about time, as you are, Sydney,
yes.
But also a reaction of there are things we can do. And it's also about knowing where and how to get the information. So I think having a dedicated block is also going to be beneficial, because we hope to be the, you know, the collator of information and be able to push it out to the general public.
Well, you know, I've been doing this side of things for a couple of years here, and the thing that I know, and it actually is somewhat frustrating in one respect, is the fact that there are so many people doing so many terrific things in small towns and communities and cities and literally all around the world, that all the things are being done. There are communities that are organizing. There are people doing miraculous things at all levels. There's awareness about our animals and our communities of animals that it's out there, but it has never had a means to have a mainstream messaging source, a means to really take all that information and put it in one place where when people want to find this out, they know where to go.
It's true.
And no one could have done this any better than Robert Redford, because he brings many, many years of professional credibility. Thank God he's been an honorable man all of his life, because we can take that to the bank. Obviously, there's been some sort of change. In order for you to make this level of commitment, something has to be happening in the larger kind of mainstream world out there, where you know, because you're not going to make this commitment unless you know you're going to succeed, that this is going to work. What's the change? What's happening? What's happening with the leaders in the industry, the entertainment industry, and others?
That's a good question. I think, well, truthfully, the issue of environmental sustainability has grown in appeal because of, I think, a vast need, you know. And it's no longer an issue that I think it can be sidelined as marginal or inconsequential. It's affecting everyone today. And if you see An Inconvenient Truth and you see photographs of 10 years ago, you know, certain polar ice caps that had, you know, 50 extra feet of ice and maybe 100 feet of stream, and it's disappeared. I think what's happening is it's becoming more relevant and more present, and it's actually happening in our lifetime. I think it was one thing when people said hundreds of years ago there were these glaciers, and at this stage now we're talking in decades. So I think the change that we're seeing is that it's truthfully, it's not just good business, it's mandatory business. So whether it's corporations, you know, environmental groups, educators, and people, as you say, in the media, film, television, industry, realize that this is like breathing, you know.
Yes.
It's truthfully affecting just day-to-day life. It's the earth, it's water, it's the air. And I think we have a very powerful means of delivering a message through film and television. And I think, truthfully, films that are doing successful, having successful runs in the theater, like, you know, Who Killed the Electric Car, are actually proving to business leaders in our community that people want to see these stories and will actually pay to see them and then walk out of the movie theater and, you know, they don't shut off at that point. I know many people who've seen these documentaries and walk out and say, okay, how can I contribute? What can I do? How can I make changes? You know, is it within my home? Is it something as simple as changing my light bulbs and getting rid of, you know, all the fluorescents? Just very simple day-to-day activity that we can all engage in that makes a difference. So I think it's smart business, but it's also mandatory business. You know, and to your point, what's interesting is the response from the corporate and business community has been very positive. And we hope to work with a number of leaders in the field of whether it's, you know, banking, financial services, automobile manufacturers, you name it. We want to work with people who actually are making some significant difference and maybe engaging in the dialogue, whether it's through design, you know, building, or just even simplifying and making manufacturing cleaner, healthier, and less of an emission polluter. These are the kind of companies that we want to work with, because it's impossible to exist without corporations. You have to. It's who we are. It's how this, you know, country is set up. But what we hope is that we find like-minded partners. And the response so far, I mean, I can't confirm anything, but the response so far has been very positive and very actually collaborative in their interest.
I like to think of this as a mainstream alternative media. Some people think of it as alternative. It isn't, truly. It's a mainstream alternative. I think Americans are hungry for reality. Reality meaning it can be fun, it can be exciting, it can be there can be fantasy involved and romance and things, but based on things that make sense and lead to a sustainable world. Globalization can be a very positive thing if we can learn to get along. And so creating visions of that so that people have something to refer to in a hopeful way is exciting. In terms of content, have you done a survey? I'm sure you have. But to what degree is the content there, and to what degree are you going to be reaching out to collect and let's say collect content first, and I'd like to also have you discuss some of the creative aspects in terms of some of your larger projects.
Sure. That's a very good question. You know what, internationally we found that there are films, documentaries being made on the subject, whether it's dealing with, you know, the oil and the energy, you know, issue, or emission control, or global warming. There are documentaries and films that we are finding. Some of them are being made by, you know, channels such as the BBC or Channel 4 in the UK or ABC in Australia or CBC in Canada. You know, there are films and documentaries. So we're going to actively solicit and hopefully acquire as many as we can, put them on the air. Plus, they give an international global perspective on how people all over the world are dealing with these,
yes,
these
right.
issues and challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of original content, the other, I think, very significant part, and this is to your point, that there's definitely not just, you know, and it's to his credit, as you said, Robert Redford's sort of dedication in terms of energy. It takes money to do this kind of programming. So we are going to be spending some resources on commissioning, again, working with producers across the U.S. who are either working in this area or are interested in producing television programming. So we've had what we call a call for submissions and worked with a number of media outlets to get the word out, you know, through our press release. And what's happened is we've had feedback now from people who are, you know, film and television producers who are pitching us on ideas, which
yeah.
is that you never know until you start getting that kind of feedback how people are going to react and what the ideas are. And I have to say they range, they're brilliant. Many of them are absolutely innovative, you know, ranging from technology and design to simple, you know, community activism, as you mentioned. And I think what you're going to find is when we commission a series, which is, you know, what I described as sort of the change agent concept, it's going to be completely original. And I want to be able to present the American public with programming that's also entertaining. It's important that it not just be doomsaying in its message, because television is a medium that, unfortunately, people have dials and can click on and off in 1 minute. So we really truly want to make it something that people will come back to each week that will be fresh, original, exclusive, never before seen, and from a very different point of view. You know, we have strong producers, you know, and I don't know if you watch the channel, but we do a lot of documentary series. We just launched a series called House of Boateng. In a month, we're launching a series called The Hill with Congressman Robert Wexler and his staffers. We have a series called One Punk Under God launching in December, which is a documentary series looking at Jay Baker, who's, you know, the son of Tammy and Tammy Faye and Jim Baker. And he has his own really interesting new version of, as he calls it, an alternative to religion called Revolution. He's a punk rock activist. So the channel's always, I think, been proudly presenting strong informational documentary programming that comes from a place of investigation, curiosity, and intrigue. We also, during the month of September for 9/11 and the 5-year, you know, memorial tribute, we've commissioned a documentary that really is, I think, going to be, it's going to be very, I think, profound in its effect, because it's a documentary, it's called Dust to Dust, The Health Effects of 9/11, and it's taking a look at all the early responders, all the medical, police, you know, fire personnel who were early responders, who were at the site immediately following, you know, the crash of the planes, and how now 5 years later, these people who really are heroes, living heroes, have now been suffering immense problems as a result of the pollution and, you know, hazards of some of the waste that came out of the, you know, out of that horrible tragedy. And so we're showing this doc where it's talking about, okay, now how do we deal with this? This is an environmental disaster, truly, as well. You know, it has affected thousands of people who live, work, and were there early. So this is the kind of programming on Sundance Channel you can expect to see. It has strong content, and it's often, you know, programming that, as you say, is truth-telling. That's what we're looking for.
Well, the illusion is fading away, and people are beginning to see through the dust clouds now, and hoping for a clearer vision of our future. Unfortunately, my cable service, I have a kind of basic cable service. I don't get Sundance, and it's a big hole in my lineup. But that also brings up another aspect of this, because there's many people who don't have access to cable and satellite. You're also backing up the Sundance Channel Green with online content that sounds like it's going to be very exciting, and will make it available for people to access various aspects of this programming, even though they can't get it through their cable and satellite networks.
It's true. It's going to be housed on the SundanceChannel.com site, which is our site, and we're going to build, we're calling, you know, it's an eco-munity, a community of people who are very active and interested and generating their own content, because I think it has to be, you know, to be vibrant and relevant, you want people to be involved, engaged, and participating. We also want to be a place where people can get information. You know, if you have a question about where can I, you know, if I have hazardous waste in my house, where can we go to our local community drop-off center and dispose of this kind of, you know, whether it's paint or, you know, toxins from the house. We want to be able to provide really current and relevant and simple but accurate information. So that's what the web will provide, and you are right. I mean, I hope to make it a reflection of what's on the channel, so that there will actually be programming content, excerpts from our shows, clips, you know, we call them interstitials, shorts, etc., that will actually either augment or reflect both, you know, that which is on the channel and then that which we can't put on the channel because there's just so much information. So it will be a very complimentary and standalone site as well.
And you've mentioned the website, but go ahead and repeat it.
SundanceChannel.com is our website. Okay. And we'll probably in the next 3 to 6 months, start what we call teasing and providing some information. It'll take a while for it to be finally up and fully running and operational, but over the next 3 to 6 months, you will find that we start talking about this, you know, putting on announcements as they come up, because the other areas, we're going to engage people both who are activists, environmentalists, and celebrities who are in this field. So over the next 3 or 4 months, you'll find that every month we hope to make an announcement either on a programming basis or on a host basis or with people who are signing up, if you will, to support the initiative.
We're talking with Laura Michael-Chishin, who is the Executive Vice President of Programming and Marketing for the Sundance Channel and is just announcing the Sundance Channel Green. I've got a great big smile on my face, and I'm going to tell you why. You are such, you really have a lot of say about what Sundance Channel does. I mean, if people were to read your resume, they'd be wildly impressed with your extraordinary impact on what they see on the Sundance Channel. But this is what I'm really impressed with, and of course it would come from Sundance. You are such an articulate spokesperson for this message. Your heart is in this, and I'm totally thrilled with that. I'm just impressed with that.
Very kind of you, Sydney. Thank you. Well, and the whole company is. We are a small company, and I say what we lack in financial resources, we make up in heart, energy, and soul.
Bingo! That's what we need right now, and you're going to empower that in a mainstream way, and that's what we need. We need to bring all this heart and soul into the mainstream, and you're well on your way to do so. Laura Michael-Chishin, thanks so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for speaking with me, Sydney. Take care.
The world is changing, and from what I see, we have the chance, if we take it, run with it, and never let it go, to start on a path to a better world, if only we start right now. Actually, we're on our way, and we continue the journey when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There are still a few people who are finally admitting that, yes, global warming is perhaps happening, but aren't willing to say that we humans had anything to do with it. But they miss the point, and that is that when we humans want to, we can truly make a difference. Remember when bald eagles were endangered? We humans made the changes that made the difference. In Yellowstone National Park, wolves were reintroduced. And things are going well, until last year, that is. It's time to find out how they're doing. Stay tuned. In many respects, nature is fragile. And yet, the other side of the story is nature is amazing at coming back, if given even some of its natural spaces to live in and multiply. A bold experiment was launched 10 years ago to see if wolves could be successfully reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park. We pick up the story now. Well, in the heat of the summer here, everyone's complaining about the heat because it's hot. We're going to go to the high country here from Montana and Wyoming to America's premier national park, Yellowstone, which was the first national park and really set the standard worldwide for parks. If you haven't been there, you need to go there because there is no park like it anywhere in the world. I've often said that if Spielberg were to design a national park, it would be Yellowstone because it has a combination of features that belong in a movie. But the amazing thing is the fact that it's real. One of the things that Yellowstone did recently was to take a bold experiment, make a bold step in trying to really demonstrate that viable wolf populations are something that we could live with in a place like Yellowstone, and introduced a wolf pack. It was really quite historical, and a gentleman who's been following this for a very long time is Douglas Smith. He's the Yellowstone Wolf Project leader. He works with the National Park Service, and really is the guy who is following what's happening with the wolf pack. Douglas, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Glad to be here, Sydney.
First of all, how's the summer up in Yellowstone? I've spent a couple of summers in Yellowstone, and everyone is unique.
Well, most importantly, in hearing your prologue there, it's hot here, too.
Yeah, it can get real hot in Yellowstone, that's for sure.
And even though we're high elevation, it's warm. But we had a wet spring, which was nice, but it's dried out quickly. We've got a small forest fire going now. But, you know, we're in the middle of summer, and we're in the middle of our summertime pup counts. So, you know, it's an interesting year like all the others you mentioned.
Hey, here's a question. I was back there in the 90s, an X number of years after the fire. It was disappointing to come into the park and see such incredible devastation, but that was 10 years ago. How's the park coming back?
Well, it's bouncing back very nicely. I mean, nature views devastation as an opportunity. And wildfires are natural and have been operating for millions of years. So that big fire of '88 was an opportunity for many plants and animals to get a foothold in places where they couldn't previously. And the other thing that's important about wildfires is that there's a lot of diversity, a mosaic of habitats, if you will, in nature. And fires are one of the best creators of these mosaics. And so the fire is actually, and again, we try not to look at nature with value judgments, but the fire had quite a bit of beneficial impacts on the park. And, you know, 12 years, well, more than that passed, we've got a lot of trees regrowing. We've got a lot of grasslands regrowing. The animals are responding. It's quite a dynamic system that's very interesting to follow.
How tall are the new pines that are growing in?
Well, it depends on site. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is very site dependent, mm-hmm. because the seed source that was there when it burned is important. Did the seeds fall and get established right away, or did they have to disperse into the area? So we're dealing with some places that are, you know, 6 to 8 feet, and other places which are twice that.
See, because when I was there, they were 6 to 8 inches.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's increased significantly more since your days.
Oh, that's great. Then the green is coming back.
It is.
Well, let's talk about another issue that's dear to your, it's what your life is about. And this is the ongoing Yellowstone Wolf Pack. Give us just a short history on that. And then when we talked last, which was last January, there was some real threats. But give us a overview of how it began and where it went to last January.
Well, in 1995 and 1996, we reintroduced 41 wolves, 31 of which were from Canada, 10 of which were pups from northwest Montana. And that population of reintroduced wolves grew rapidly. There was a lot of variation, but roughly at a 10% population increase per year. They topped out at 174 wolves in 14 packs in 2003.
Wow.
In 2004, we had roughly the same number of wolves as we did in 2003, and then we had a huge population decline. The population dropped by 30% from 169 to 118, and most of that was due to pups. We had only 22 pups survive last year out of about 65 born. And so that's a very poor survival rate, the lowest of any year. And so we suspected disease of some kind. And we drew blood a number of wolves over the winter, which has antibodies in their blood if they were exposed to a certain disease or not. And sure enough, we found evidence that they had been exposed to a dog disease called canine parvovirus. In fact, every wolf we tested this winter tested positive to exposure with canine parvovirus. We also suspect that distemper came through. We caught a wolf with malformed teeth, discolored teeth. That's symptomatic of distemper. So we had at least one, possibly two or more diseases sweep through our population last year that really caused a big drop in wolf numbers.
What's the general sort of survival rate for an animal that's exposed?
Oh, wow, it's usually...
I know.
The mortality can be 80-90%.
I know. When we talked, that's what you were talking about, that you had a real concern that this could continue to devastate the population. Yeah.
Well, and that's a good question, Sydney. It looks like that has not been the case. These disease outbreaks can function in two different ways. They can always be around and cause mortality every year, or they can kind of have a boom-bust cycle where there's an outbreak and then a quiet period for a number of years. And so far, and my fingers are crossed right now, and I'm knocking on wood in my office, this is a very good year for pups, 2006. We're looking so far at about a 90% survival rate for the pups that were born in April, which is astoundingly high. Normally, over summer survival is about 60 to 70%. So we're running above average, but the summer's not over, and we still could get more pup mortality. But that indicates, and this has often been the case, that when you get a very poor year, you can get a bounce back year.
Yeah.
We call that compensation. In other words, the number of pups living this year compensate for the number of pups that died last year. So far, so good this year.
Now, I'm just curious if you've noticed a increase in litter size, because it's amazing how nature has these systems that I don't think anybody can explain, but how in times when they feel somehow nature may help to increase the litter size, literally, if they're hit by something that really diminishes their population. I'm just curious if you've noticed that from a scientific perspective.
Well, we haven't run the numbers yet on litter size this year. Off the top of my head, it looks a little up. We do have larger litters, but the key thing that affects this wolf population, as does a lot of other wolf populations, is pup survival.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the last 5 years, the number of pups born in Yellowstone has gone up each year. We're getting more pups hitting the ground in spring every year. However, the survival of those pups has been declining.
Mm-hmm.
So even though there's more born, not as many make it. And that is what we call density dependent in biology. The more animals you have, the less well they do. And there appears to be some of that going on for these Yellowstone wolves.
This is also the time of summer when you're going out and really doing some of these surveys on the pups. How do you go out and do your actual field work?
Well, it's tough. I mean, wolves don't let you look at them. They're secretive, they're shy, they don't like people. So a lot of it is we fly from aircraft. So we're in the sky above. We use digital photography, which we can take from hundreds of feet above. We see the pups out in the open. We take pictures. We come back and we count them up. So the key time is May, June, because most of the time in May, June, there's a lot of pups around. And then we do the same thing again in November, December. And that's how we determine number of pups born compared to the number of pups that survive. So, and right now we're still... There's a couple dens in the park that we haven't been able to see yet. For example, today from the airplane, we were able to see a couple more litters of pups that might not be representative of what was born because it's July, but we're just trying to get looks in at where the packs are and count their young.
Now, I know when you started out, radio tracking was absolutely critical for your work. Now that you're down the road here X number of years, how much is that still playing a role?
Oh, radio tracking's key. I can't overemphasize that, and it's somewhat controversial because it's a national park, and people don't like seeing marked wildlife, and they don't like airplanes flying when they come to reach solitude from a big city, and I totally respect that viewpoint. However, the controversy about wolves is not going away, Sydney. In fact, it's increasing a lot, and wolves are so subject to mythology, legends, stories, misinformation, that to live with wolves, and everybody agrees, living with wolves is harder than living without them. life is definitely more difficult when wolves are around, but I think they're worth it. And to live with them, to understand them, we've got to have some of them radio-marked. Now, we only have about 30% of the population radio-marked. And really, virtually everything we know about wolves, except maybe two or three studies, has come about through putting radio collars on them. I mean, we've got to find a way to follow them around, observe them, and take notes. And if we're going to have wolves in this day and age of increasing human populations and habitat loss, we've got to know how to manage them, live with them, deal with them. And radio collars do that. So that's an essential part of the program. I'm sorry it's got to be that way. When I go to a wild area, I like it to be quiet and peaceful too. And so we actually cut back some of our work in the summer because that's the time when people visit. So I am very, very sensitive to this issue. But like everything else in the world today, we've got to reach compromises.
Well, I know in terms of population studies, there has been no better advance than radio telemetry, collaring, etc., because you can really learn the very specific movements of animals and packs, in the case of wolves, that otherwise you couldn't possibly know.
Absolutely,
so,
correct.
And no matter what you do in these realms, you're going to have those people who are for you and those people who are against you. So you just have to take your stand on what you think is right and live with that. That's just, there's no other way around it.
That seems to be our world today, doesn't it?
Pretty much, exactly right. I read in the paper today an article that up in your area there, is it Wyoming or Montana?
Wyoming.
It's Wyoming, where there's quite an effort to have the state keep the wolves off the endangered species list. Talk about that a little bit. That's a rather interesting politics being played out.
Well, wolves are controversial, and the human debate over wolves will never end. I mean,
that's right. Yeah,
sociologically, a very interesting case study for people because it's so polarized. There's very few people in the middle who are neutral about wolves. You either love them or you hate them. It's that simple. And those groups both have a lot of political clout, so they clash. And the current clash deals with delisting wolves. And very simply, it's more complicated than this, but very simply, to delist wolves, you have to have a minimum population size, and we have that. And you have to have acceptable state management plans, because currently wolves are managed by the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so right now we've got enough wolves to delist. However, the Wyoming State Wolf Management Plan was rejected as adequate by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And Wyoming sued twice and lost. They sued and lost and then appealed and lost. And they've just requested through a petition that wolves be delisted. And because they did not change their management plan, the Fish and Wildlife Service has refused to delist until the Wyoming State Management Plan is changed. And so it's an impasse now. And Wyoming, I think in the paper today, said that they were probably going to take further legal action.
Yeah.
And so delisting right now is in a stalemate, despite the fact that there's an adequate number of wolves to initiate the process.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's outside the park.
The park is included. The delisting includes the entire region of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming.
Oh, wow.
And so the delisting is based on three populations, central Idaho, northwest Montana, and the Yellowstone ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And so those three recovery areas are linked together. And together, they have enough wolves. In fact, over enough wolves. But again, the administrative side of the equation has not been resolved. And that is being resolved in the courts, it looks like.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you also, in terms of the wolves that are getting outside of the park, what's happening with them these days? I know that, you know, they're very often attacked, shot, things happen to them, but what are you finding out?
They have not been delisted, but because Idaho and Montana have approved and acceptable management plans, the state government is managing wolves in Idaho and Montana. So when there's conflicts with livestock, wolves are killed.
Right.
When they're verified. In Wyoming, outside the park, the state is not involved because of the dispute over their management plan. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is still managing the wolves in Wyoming outside of Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's conflicts with livestock, wolves are also killed. Mm. And so that's kind of the scenario. I work in Yellowstone, and we do have livestock. There are horses that use the backcountry every night, but we've not, so far in the 12 years I've been here, had a problem with wolves attacking horses. It would be very different if they did in terms of what we do, because this is a national park, and our policy mandate is preservation.
Well, Dougie, how long now have you been involved with the Yellowstone Wolf Pack?
I've been involved with the wolf program in Yellowstone since its inception. I got here in November 94. Before there were any wolves, I was brought in to reintroduce and study and manage the wolf population. We brought the wolves in January 95. I've been at duty ever since.
Well, obviously, you are one of America's leading wolf people. You live and breathe wolves. This would be my question, because I find them absolutely fascinating. I grew up in Minnesota with the following the legacy of Meech and others, some of the early wolf researchers, and it was fascinating stuff. And I myself am fascinated by wolves and their behavior. After this long, what is it that you personally, and then also from the perspective of scientist and researcher, what are you coming to understand about wolves that perhaps you never thought you'd know?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, wolves. There's three things that make a wolf. They're social. They're very much like people. They live in family groups and they interact socially. They travel. They have a need to travel. That's why it's always hard for me to see wolves in captivity, because they just pace back and forth. And to live, they have to kill. And that makes them controversial. And it's those three things that we study a lot. And we're also learning that wolves are very important to the ecological integrity of wild ecosystems. And it's hard to think of an area as truly natural if you don't have the top dog, so to speak, the top carnivore present. So we're learning, and this is controversy as well among scientists. I have to say that almost everything about wolves has a controversy to it. But that's that the effect of wolves in Yellowstone is rippling through everything. Maybe everything is too strong a statement, but certainly we're learning that Yellowstone is different now than it was before wolf reintroduction.
I think you talked, last time we talked about such things as sapling growth along some of the rivers is increasing because ungulates aren't available, and so there's actually greater greening up along the riverbanks.
Well, we've had a greening up of willow. Willow have been suppressed in Yellowstone for over a century, and now they're growing much more rapidly. Mm-hmm. And it's debated what the cause of that is. But one of the leading hypotheses is that wolves have something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the ripple effects of more willow, it affects beavers, it affects songbirds and things of that nature. But again, that's, you know, we're midstream in terms of resolving that. Not everybody agrees. Some people think it has to do with climate and other factors such as that. But certainly, so far, everybody I've met and talked to agrees Yellowstone's different with wolves than without them.
Fascinating. For people who are in Yellowstone, planning to come to Yellowstone, if they want to see wolves, so what do you try to advise them to do?
Well, early morning, the first 2 hours of daylight's the best. The last 2 hours of daylight is good, but not as good as early morning. And the northern quarter of the park, the northern tier road is the best road to drive to try and see them. And so get up early and drive not the loop, but the northern road, and look for the traffic jam.
Hmm.
Because we are estimating about 325,000 people a year are seeing wolves in Yellowstone.
Wow.
So when one is spotted, it's a sensation.
Yeah,
it's a big deal, and so if there's a traffic jam, it's either a wolf or a grizzly, so stop and take a look.
Douglas Smith, who's the Yellowstone Wolf Project Leader at Yellowstone National Park, he's the guy who really knows all about this stuff. If people want to find out more about what you guys are doing and your research, what's the best way for them to get to the source?
Well, we've made a number of publications. The park's got a website, and if you work your way through that website, Yellowstone National Park, if you Google that, you'll get our webpage. And you can work through that to get to the wolf section. And there's a couple related links that will tell you all about wolves.
Great. Well, Douglas, thank you so much. I wish we had more time, but I appreciate this update. Thanks for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News, Douglas.
No problem, Sydney. I always enjoy talking to you. You're always on top of things.
Thanks so much.
You bet.
At the pace that things are changing these days, it's hard to say what will be happening on planet Earth when November comes. But one thing you can be sure of, we'll be checking in again with Doug Smith to get a further update on those wolf pups. But now it's time to move along to our final feature. We just celebrated the wild creatures, but millions of animals are held captive to produce food and become food on farms across the country. These are hard times for the farmers and their food machines. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The summer heat brings out the urge to fire up the Barbie and start grilling some steaks or hot dogs, and of course, barbecued chicken. But it's not only the beef and chicken on the grill that's hot. So too are the chickens and pigs and calves and ducks that spend their lives, for whatever that's worth, on corporate farms, waiting to serve the hungry one way or another. These animals deserve protections, and the Humane Society of the United States takes them under their wings. So, don't fly away just yet. Every morning we wake up, or in the evening we look at the evening news and we see these record-setting temperatures that are affecting everybody. The topic that most people are concerned about is how it's affecting the urban humans, and rightfully so, because quite honestly it threatens them just as much as it threatens any other life forms, and we are literally dying at this time. Some of us are. Those people, the elderly and people who are particularly susceptible to these conditions. But all across America, there's a huge industry that keeps us alive as well, and that is literally the animals that we find on farms that provide food for us in one way or another. They, too, have to deal with these unusual conditions, and to learn more about that, we're now being joined by Paul Shapiro. He's the director of the Factory Farming Campaign with the Humane Society of the United States. He's joining us from Gaithersburg, Maryland. Paul, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks so much, Sydney.
Well, let's talk about the unique challenges that farm animals across America are facing. And let's first of all, just give us an inventory of the animals that we're most concerned about right now.
The overwhelming majority of animals who are raised for food in the United States are chickens. Of course, there are other animals who are also used for food, turkeys, pigs, cows, sheep, and so on. And many people, when they think about where our food comes from, they conjure up images of old McDonald's farm. That is, they envision pigs cooling themselves in mud baths, chickens strutting through barnyards, calves suckling from their mothers, when in reality, virtually nothing could be further from the truth. The unfortunate reality for most farm animals in this country is that they are warehoused on what are known as factory farms. These are industrialized complexes where animals are confined in spaces that are extremely restrictive, and in some cases, they're unable even to turn around or fully extend their limbs. So you can imagine, in the summertime, without the ability to move or to properly space themselves from other animals, how this could have tremendous negative consequences for the animal's welfare.
One would think, from a business perspective, that at a certain point here, these animals are being put at risk. Is that happening?
It certainly is the case that many of these animals are at risk. In the summertime, we have higher mortality rates for animals who are being trucked to slaughter plants, for example. Of course, transport trucks for farm animals are not climate controlled. The animals do not have access to water or to food. And so you have a situation where the animals are exposed to extremely high temperatures. If there's an accident and there are the truck has to remain on the road for quite some time, mortality rates start to skyrocket. If there is any type of delay, you can have serious problems. And if there's any type of malfunction on one of these factory farms, you could have, within minutes, tens of thousands of dead animals. These factory farms are intensively confined, in some cases even hundreds of thousands of animals, and so a huge amount of automation is required to keep the fans and the ventilation going. And if those type of systems break down, you could be looking at animals overheating and in some cases even dying by the tens of thousands.
Well, now, are you receiving reports of animals that are endangered or are under stress right now?
Well, we did recently hear of a case. A worker at a pig farm told us about a case where the curtains on the side of this confinement facility did not raise in the morning, and so the pigs overheated, and they had nearly 100 pigs die that morning alone.
You know, this is not going to be the story that everybody's going to necessarily pay close attention to, because, quite honestly, for most of us, we don't give it much thought. For many people in urban environments and other places, we rarely even see these animals, except perhaps in one form or another, in our grocery stores. So let's go ahead and just talk to people, though, who this is their business. Educate them. Let's talk to them about things that they need to be aware of now to really deal with this extraordinary heat that's gripping the nation.
Well, there's unfortunately been a drive toward consolidation within the animal agribusiness industry. And so over the last few decades, the rule within animal agriculture has really been to get big or to get out. And so you have more animals than ever before being raised for food, yet you have fewer farmers than ever before because of this massive consolidation. And after several decades of intensification in the livestock industry, it's time that we start de-intensifying the industry, to start giving the animals more space than they currently have. And that's not only better for the animals, it's better for a whole host of reasons. And as far as the heat is concerned, of course, animals who do have the ability to cool themselves, whether it be ducks in water or pigs in mud, those animals are going to be much safer from the type of inherent problems that you have when you have intensive confinement situations where animals are never able to control their own body temperature.
Well, be specific. Go ahead. What animals do people have to really pay attention to?
Well, for example, ducks. There are virtually no duck farms of any serious size, any commercial duck factory farms that allow the ducks the ability to submerge themselves in water. And keep in mind, these are waterfowl. It is essential. They have webbed feet. They're supposed to be in the water. But ducks who don't have access to water can overheat very quickly, and they are at a very high risk. Even further, ducks who are not only being raised for duck meat, but also for the so-called delicacy known as foie gras, are at especially high risk because these animals are being force-fed on a daily basis, causing their livers to enlarge and inflicting them with a state of disease. And so ducks especially are at extremely high risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead and talk about their conditions. Are they confined in small cages, or what is their status?
Most ducks in this country are not confined in small cages, but they are confined indoors in pens, suspended above pits of their own manure at pretty much all times. And so it's a very bleak existence that these animals lead. Perhaps, though, the most bleak of all the existences is really the plight of the egg-laying hen in this country. There are about 300 million egg-laying hens in the United States, and almost all of them are confined in barren battery cages. These are cages that are so restrictive the birds are unable even to spread their wings. The birds generally are in a cage with maybe 7 or 8 other birds, so they're in a constant state of friction against one another, making it extremely difficult for them to cool themselves down. And heat is just one of the problems. Of course, these facilities have fans, but if there's any problem that goes on with electrically, you can have a huge number of animals dying. But again, heat is only one of the problems. These animals lead lives of daily frustration and suffering, no matter what the temperature is, because of their extraordinarily close confinement. The confinement of these birds in battery cages is so abusive that a number of European countries have outlawed it on animal welfare grounds. Yet here in the United States, on this issue, we are lagging behind. However, the good news is that there are a number of retailers that are implementing exclusively cage-free egg policies. That's to say they will not sell any eggs from birds who have been confined in battery cages, and they'll only sell cage-free eggs. And this is very good news, and it's a positive step in the right direction that we at the Humane Society of the United States want to applaud.
In the timber industry, you have the FSC, which is Certified Sustainable Resources. In terms of cage-free eggs, or are we expecting to see at some point little icons on an egg that tell us that that's part of that's the source?
Well, any egg that's laid by a cage-free hen is probably in a carton that says cage-free on it. However, there is a dizzying array of animal welfare-related labels that end up on egg cartons, and it's enough to make any consumer confused. So what consumers ought to do is check out egglabels.com. It's our website that explains what conditions are like for the birds under each of these labels, whether or not that label is accompanied by any type of third-party auditing to verify for compliance, and so on. So again, egglabels.com is the best way to check out what the label on the carton actually means.
We're already hearing about some areas where power is disappearing. I'm sure we're going to start hearing about brownouts and even blackouts. It could happen right now, you know.
Yeah.
That would be a particularly dangerous situation based on what you're talking about, where, for example, fans would go off. Is there any way to protect those animals at a time like that?
Well, most importantly would be to have a backup system so that in the case of a blackout, many factory farms are equipped with backup systems, because if the fans go off in the middle of the summer, you could be looking at tens if not hundreds of thousands of dead animals in very short order.
I think one of the frustrations that people may have, most people, is the fact that they really are so removed from food production that it just isn't on their radar screen. And so in terms of really being able to impact these issues, I think they feel a little helpless. But obviously there are things that they can do. Let's talk about, first of all, if a person does come across a situation in their community where they see what appears to be some sort of abuse of farm animals, what's their first course of action?
If someone comes across a case of animal neglect or of animal cruelty, the first thing that they ought to do is to contact their local authorities. All 50 states have anti-cruelty statutes. Now, that's not to say that the authorities will take all complaints seriously or investigate or prosecute, but it is important, first and foremost, to contact the local authorities to make sure they're aware of the situation. People can also contact us here at the Humane Society of the United States and give us a call at 202-452-1100 and report these type of cases. And we can also work with the authorities to help make sure that these animals are helped, and if there is a violation of the cruelty code, to ensure that there's some type of appropriate response there. But also, on a more fundamental level, there are many things that each one of us can do to help improve the plight of farm animals, whether or not we come across a situation in which we're actually a witness to farm animal cruelty. Right now, in Congress, there is a bill pending called the Farm Animal Stewardship Purchasing Act, And that bill would mandate that any animal products the federal government purchases must come from animals who had the ability to turn around, extend all their limbs, were not starved, were not force-fed, and were given adequate veterinary care. Now, this doesn't seem like a particularly radical set of standards, but the plight of farm animals in our country today is so poor that there are millions of farm animals who are treated in ways that would violate these standards. So we think it's important for citizens to contact their representatives in Congress and to let them know that you want them to support the Farm Animal Stewardship Purchasing Act. It's otherwise known as H.R. 5557, and it's co-sponsored by Congressman Chris Shays, a Republican from Connecticut, and Congressman Pete DeFazio, a Democrat from Oregon. And we want to make sure that the Farm Animal Stewardship Purchasing Act, H.R. 5557, gets the hearing that it deserves, gets an up or down vote, and gets passed through Congress and signed by the President.
And not to become too political, but is this falling along any sort of party lines?
No, compassion for animals is a bipartisan issue. Everyone from Senator Robert Byrd, a Democrat from West Virginia, to Congressman Dennis Kucinich, a Democrat from Ohio, to Republican members of Congress like Bob Dole, the former Republican nominee for president, or Matthew Scully, George W. Bush's former speechwriter, are all supporters of animal welfare, including farm animal welfare. In fact, Matthew Scully published a fantastic book called Dominion, in which he calls for a Humane Farming Act, which would include a ban on some of the worst agribusiness cruelties, such as battery cages for egg-laying hens, veal crates for young male calves, gestation crates for breeding pigs, and so on. And so there definitely is not voting on party lines when it comes to the welfare of animals. Compassion for animals is certainly a bipartisan issue.
That's good to know. It would feel absolutely wrong if that weren't the case. I do believe that compassion is a human character, not a political virtue. You've really covered a lot of topics here, and I certainly encourage people to contact you if they want to learn more about this from the perspective of the Humane Society as well, the factory farming campaign. Is there a way for them to do so?
Absolutely. If folks want to check out the HSUS Factory Farming Campaign website, they can go to humaneeating.com.
Humaneeating.com. Very easy.
I think these animals have the capacity to enjoy their lives. They have the capacity to suffer. They have the capacity to be happy. And unfortunately, because of our mistreatment of them, we oftentimes force them to endure suffering that they really shouldn't have to endure.
Well, Paul Shapiro, Director of the Factory Farming Campaign with the Humane Society of the United States, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much, Sydney. It's been a pleasure.
Here's a little secret. We're going to win this one. We are. We're getting wiser and better organized, and a whole huge breadth of people are coming to the same conclusion. We want our world back as it was, provided to each of us on the day we were born. We all have a secret understanding of what that was, and we carry it around in a sacred place, somewhere in our soul. Now, let the soul emerge and take us all to the place we can become one with the paradise of our little planet Earth. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or Friday if the internet fails, or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.